After Nadia's death, Zhenya almost moved in to watch over Stalin. In 1934, it seems, this relationship grew into something more. Statuesque and blue-eyed, with wavy blonde hair, dimples, an upturned nose and wide, beaming mouth, Zhenya, 36, was a priest's daughter from Novgorod. She was not beautiful, but her golden skin and her quick, mischievous nature radiated health. When she was pregnant with her daughter Kira, she split some logs just before giving birth. She had known Stalin since marrying Nadia's brother, Pavel, around the revolution, but they had been abroad a lot and returned from Berlin just before the suicide. Then a fresh relationship developed between Stalin the widower and this funny, blithe woman. The marriage of Pavel and Zhenya had almost ended in the early 30s, when Stalin ordered them to stay together. Despite having given the pistol to Nadia, Pavel often stayed with Stalin. Zhenya was unafraid of Stalin. The first time she arrived at Dzhubalova after her return from Berlin, she found a meal on the table and ate it all. Stalin then walked in and asked, "Where's my onion soup?" Zhenya admitted she had eaten it. This might have provoked an explosion, but Stalin merely smiled and said, "Next time, they'd better make two." She said whatever she thought. She was well-read, and Stalin consulted her about what he should read. She suggested an Egyptian history, but joked that he started copying the pharaohs. Stalin admired Zhenya's joie de vivre. She made him laugh uproariously with her earthy wit. She could not help tactlessly puncturing the balloons of the stiff party women, and Stalin always enjoyed playing off his courtiers. When Polina Molotova, mistress of the perfume industry, boasted to Stalin that she was wearing her latest product, Red Moscow, Stalin sniffed. "That's why you smell so nice," he said. "Come on, Yosef," interrupted Zhenya. "She smells of Chanel No. 5. This made the family enemies among the politicians at a time when politics were about to become a blood sport. Nonetheless, she alone could get away with these comments because Stalin respected her irreverence. When Svetlana, maturing early, appeared in her first skirt, Stalin lectured her on Bolshevik modesty, but asked Zhenya, "Can a girl wear a dress like that? I don't want her to bare her knees." "It's only natural," replied Zhenya. "And she asks for money," said the father. "That's all right, isn't it?" "What's the money for?" he persisted. "A person can live well on 10 kopecks. "Come on, Yosef," Zhenya teased him. "That was before the revolution."
"I thought you could live on 10 kopecks, murmured Stalin.
"What are they doing, printing special newspapers for you?" Only Zhenya could say this sort of thing to him. Stalin and Zhenya probably became lovers at this time. Historians never know what happens behind bedroom doors, but Maria Svanidze observed their relationship and recorded it in her diary, which Stalin himself preserved. That summer, Maria spotted how Zhenya went out of her way to be alone with Stalin. He treated her very affectionately. There is other evidence, too. Later in the 30s, Beria approached Zhenya with an offer that sounds like Stalin's clumsy proposal of marriage. When she remarried after her husband's death, Stalin reacted with jealous fury. Zhenya was far from the only attractive woman around Stalin. During the mid-30s, he was still enjoying a normal social life, with an entourage that included a cosmopolitan circle of young and flighty women. But for the moment, it was Zhenya who sat at Stalin's feet. Just after the birthday party, the assassin Nikolaev and his 14 co-defendants were tried in Leningrad. The judge, Ulrich, called Stalin for orders. "Finish it," the Vosht ordered laconically. Following the 1st of December law, they were shot within an hour, and their innocent families soon after. In the month of December, 6,501 people were shot. Stalin had no precise plan for the growing terror, just the belief that the party had to be terrorized into submission and that old enemies had to be eradicated. Opportunistic and supersensitive, Stalin meandered towards his goal. The NKVD could not link Leningrad to the Moscow center of Zinoviev and Kamenev, but it had the means to persuade its prisoners to do so. By mid-January, they had indeed encouraged a prisoner to implicate Zinoviev and Kamenev, who were sentenced to 10 and 5 years, respectively. Stalin distributed a secret letter that warned that all the opposition had to be treated like white guards and arrested and isolated. The flood of arrests was so huge that the camps were deluged by Kirov's torrent, yet simultaneously Stalin orchestrated a jazz-playing thaw. "Life has become merrier, comrades," he said. "Life has become better." On the 11th of January, Stalin and most of the Politburo attended a gala celebration of the Soviet film industry at the Bolshoi. Stalin personally controlled a Soviet Hollywood through the State Film Board run by Boris Shumyatsky, with whom he had been in exile. Stalin did not merely interfere in movies, he minutely supervised the directors and films down to their scripts. His archive reveals how he even helped to write the songs. The magnates discussed how to manage Sergei Eisenstein, the Latvian-German-Jewish avant-garde director of Battleship Potemkin. He had lingered too long in Hollywood and, as Stalin informed the American novelist Upton Sinclair, lost the trust of his friends in the USSR. Eisenstein was lured back and put to work on Bezhin Meadow, inspired by the story of Pavlik Morozov, the boy hero who denounced his own father for kulakism. The tawdry project did not turn out as Stalin hoped. Eisenstein was saved by Molotov and Zhdanov, who were willing to give the director another chance, but Stalin knew Eisenstein was very talented. As tensions rose with Germany, he was commissioned to make a film about that vanquisher of foreign invaders, Alexander Nevsky, promoting Stalin's new paradigm of socialism and nationalism. Stalin was delighted with it. Mikoyan and Khrushchev later blamed Kaganovich for encouraging Stalin's concealed vanity and inventing Stalinism. "Why do you eulogize me as if a single person decides everything?" asked Stalin. Meanwhile, he personally supervised the cult that was flourishing in the newspapers. In Pravda, Stalin was mentioned in half the editorials between 1933 and 1939. He was always given flowers and photographed with children. The planes that flew over Red Square formed the word Stalin in the skies. Pravda declared, "Stalin's life is our life, our beautiful present and future." When he appeared at the 7th Congress of Soviets, 2,000 delegates screamed and cheered. There were similar cults for the others. Kaganovich was celebrated as Iron Lazar and the Iron Commissar, and in thousands of pictures at parades. Voroshilov was honored in the Voroshilov Rations for the Army and the Voroshilov Marksman's Prize, and his birthday celebrations were so grandiose that Stalin gave one of his most famous speeches at them. Cities were named after the magnates. Schoolchildren traded picture postcards of these heroes like football players, the dashing Voroshilov trading at a much higher price than the dour Molotov. In Stalin's many battles between vainglory and humility, he simultaneously encouraged eulogy and despised it. When the Museum of the Revolution asked if they could display the original manuscripts of his works, he wrote back, "If the book is published in millions, why do you need the manuscript? I burned all the manuscripts." He was aware of the absurdities of the cult, intelligent enough to know that the worship of slaves was surely worthless. A student at a technical college was threatened with jail for throwing a paper dart that struck Stalin's portrait. The student appealed to Stalin, who backed him. "They've wronged you," he wrote. "I ask, do not punish him." Then he joked, "The good marksman who hits the target should be praised." Death again touched the Politburo on the 25th of January, 1935, when Valerian Kuibyshev, who was 47, died unexpectedly of heart disease and alcoholism, just 8 weeks after his friend Kirov. Since he had questioned the NKVD investigation and allied himself with Kirov and Sergo, it has been claimed that he was murdered by his doctors. But one has to conclude that there were some natural deaths in the 1930s. This heroic drinker had been ill for a while. Nonetheless, it was well-timed for Stalin, who took the opportunity on the 1st of February to promote two younger stars who were the very spirit of the age. As Kaganovich took over the colossal job of running the railways, he handed over Moscow to Nikita Khrushchev, the semi-literate worker who would one day succeed Stalin.